pandemic, we call it a town as well. We call it a plague because, you know, town is not necessarily a certain kind of disease, if I'm not mistaken. It can be even applied to different types of diseases.
If, you know, if even if it's referred to different kind of disease, we cannot adapt it and we cannot compare it to the, for example, coronavirus. Mm-hmm. You know, this adaptation, or I want to say that we cannot impose our understanding to the events which are occurring in this world. Mm-hmm. We cannot do that. Okay.
True.
I want to say that generally speaking, we have this narration by a specific definition from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, but we cannot adapt it and we cannot say that this disease referring to the, for example, COVID-19 or mm-hmm. coronavirus.
So we cannot, as you said, we cannot actually connect it to that, but it might be connected, right? So it is also a possibility, is it? Isn't it?
You know, as far as I understand from the, you know, narrations of Ahlul Bayt and from this particular narration, Ta'un cannot be, you know, compared to this disease that we are talking about. I mean, the COVID-19, we cannot compare it to that.
Why?
Okay? Because Ta'un is usually, you know, in the narration referring to some specific kind of disease, you know, which mm-hmm. has its character and its particularity.
Yeah.
And because of that, we cannot say that, for example, of course, many other, you know, disease has been mentioned in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt. But after all, we cannot compare it and we cannot adapt it to mm-hmm. the, you know, COVID-19, or of course, with a different variety of that.
Yeah.
As you know, because, you know, a physician has been mentioned that it has a lot of variety, you know, by different names of that. So, and even the entity of this coronavirus is not clear, maybe for some of the scientists. So, after all, we cannot do this comparison and we cannot say that this narration referring to that particular disease that we are talking about.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Since it has been used, I mean, the word, the, let's say, adverb of white, or let's say adjective of white, has been used to name this disease, that is white death. Corona itself is whitening the lungs by its virus. So can it also be applied to that as well?
Of course not. We cannot mm-hmm. do this. We cannot do that because it requires a lot of, you know, justification in mm-hmm. order to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, generally speaking, when we talk about some kind of disease, which has, especially about the sign for the before the end of time, mm-hmm. we just want to, our mind, we want to create some kind of comparison between the what has been mentioned in the narrations and compare it to whatever is, you know, that we are dealing with. But maybe we can have, as you mentioned about the definition of plague, maybe you can find some similarity between these, you know, two kinds of diseases.
Yeah.
But after all, we cannot be sure about that.
Okay. So we cannot be sure, but can we deny it 100% or no?
Of course, when we are not sure about this comparison, mm-hmm. we cannot say that this title, which has been mentioned in that narration, mm-hmm. is actually talking about that disease.
Okay.
You know, technically speaking, we say that we should have kind of ihraz, which
yeah.
means we should be 100% sure that this disease that Imam mentioned and this title is conferring and is attached to that disease that we are talking about. Okay?
Very true.
So when we are not sure 100%, okay, mm-hmm. we cannot do this comparison.
Okay, that's taken for granted, noted. Let's ask the question in another form. Suppose that we are not sure that this kind of disease can be the same disease that it has been mentioned in the hadith. But can we at least put 1% of possibility of being the same disease? I mean, yes, for interpretation of the hadith and narration, that's right. So we say, okay, we have not received to certainty that this is the same disease that the Imam said. But since we don't have that knowledge, that comprehensive knowledge that Imam has, we can at least put 1% of possibility for those who are going to do the research, to continue researching on that. Is it possible?
Of course, maybe about 1%, maybe we can have these possibilities, but these possibilities are not valid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
I want to say that talking about the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, we should emphasize uncertain signs.
Yeah.
Alamat hatmiye, okay?
Yeah.
Which has been mentioned.
But it is not among the certain signs of Imam's advent.
Of course. About these certain signs for Imam al-Mahdi before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, for example, celestial sound or cry, and the coming of Sufyani,
mm-hmm.
okay,
yeah.
and Qiyam-e Yamani, which has been mentioned in our narration, the uprising.
Yamani's uprising.
Yamani's uprising, yes, and the killing of Nafs-e Zakiyya or the murder of Nafs-e Zakiyya. Of course, it has many other explanations attached to these signs, certain signs for the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi mm-hmm. salatu wassalam. I want to say that, generally speaking, we should focus on these five certain signs before the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi. But other signs, maybe we can find among them some sure signs for the, maybe there are, some possibilities that maybe other signs are, to some extent, could be accurate for the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi or authentic one. But, after all, other signs, maybe we cannot have certainty that those signs are for sure occur before the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Okay. Thank you very much, dear Shaykh, for your scholarly explanation and enlightenment on the issue. We have reached to the answer that these sort of, let's say, pandemic and diseases cannot be applied and adapted with the white death, which we have it in the hadith and narrations of the advent of Imam alayhi salam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So it's better to refrain from making such comparisons and actually adapting such issues with the narrations. And just ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to hasten their appearance of Imam alayhi salam. Till our next session, I'd like to leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Hussein and Hassan. homage to the Prophet's fourth infallible heir. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and congratulations to you all on another auspicious day. In fact, the third consecutive day of celebrations of the blessed month of Sha'ban. Today is the 5th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala. Stay with us for an exclusive feature on the fourth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Whenever a thought comes to your mind that you are better than any other person, then think along these lines. If the person is older than you, then remind yourself that he is better than you in matters of Islam because he has done more good deeds than you have. If the person is younger than you, then remind yourself that this person is better than you because he has committed less sins than you have. If he is of your age, then your argument should be, he is better than you in matters of Islam, since you know of your own sins but not of his. What you heard are bezels of wisdom, but these are not the words of any philosopher who might have arrived at this undeniable truth after years of contemplation and a life of stumbling in the dark. As a matter of fact, these golden guidelines for our salvation were taught to us by a person who was free of any faults and whimsical thoughts, since he was a member of that select group called the Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless cleanliness and pristine purity God Almighty has vouchsafed in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab of the Noble Quran. He's the person whose birthday we celebrate every year on the 5th of Sha'ban. To be more precise, he is Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, peace upon him, famous as Zainul Abidin, or Ornament of the Worshippers of God, who was born in Medina over a millennium and four centuries ago in the year 38 AH, 2 years before the martyrdom of his grandfather, the one and only commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. As the son and successor of the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, he was the direct great-grandson of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. His mother was the princess of Persia, Hazrat Shahrbanu, peace upon her, daughter of the last Sasanid emperor of Iran, Iraq, Yazgird III, and because of that lady's pious personality, he was often called Ibnul Khiyaratain, meaning son of the two excellent ones. Such an impeccable lineage did not mean that life was a bed of roses for him and his family. After losing his mother to the cold hands of death while still an infant, he was brought up by his immaculate paternal aunt, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her. He had entered the third year of his life when he saw the end of the only instance of the model government of social justice in 48, with the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, in Kufa, where the Prophet's divinely designated heir was struck on the head by the poisoned sword of the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam. Some 7 months later, in 41 AH, the caliphate, or temporal rule of the vast Muslim realm, was deceitfully seized from his uncle and future father-in-law, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, by the rebellious governor of Syria, Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. The boy found the noble Ahlul Bayt under renewed persecution, as they had been since the passing away of the Prophet in 11 AH. The usurpation of the right of political leadership of his grandfather Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the tragic martyrdom of his grandmother, the noblest lady of all times, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. When he reached the age of 12, the divine mantle of Imamat came to rest on the shoulders of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, following the martyrdom of his uncle through a fatal dose of poison by the charlatan Muawiyah. Now his father became the target of enmity of the hypocrites, masquerading as Muslims, especially the accursed Umayyad regime. In 60 AH, as a 22-year-old in the full bloom of youth, he had to hurriedly leave Medina along with his father and the rest of the family, when the godless Yazid usurped the caliphate and demanded allegiance to his tyrannical rule. In early 61 AH, the caravan of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, arrived on the fateful plain of Karbala, where on the day of Ashura, the 23-year-old sick and bedridden man witnessed the tragic martyrdom of his father, brothers, uncles, cousins, and close companions of the Ahlul Bayt. It was under these heartening conditions that Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, formally took charge of the divine trust of Imamat, which began with chains and fetters around his limbs, and the forced march of the mainly women and children survivors of history's most heart-wrenching tragedy to Kufa, and then to Damascus in Syria, the capital of Yazid. As the fourth infallible heir of the seal of messengers, his frail figure now rose to the occasion. He delivered a moving sermon to the people of Kufa, who were watching in amusement the parading of the noble captives with heads of the martyrs mounted on lanes. After waving his hand to calm them down, he said, "O people of Kufa, I am the son of Hussein, peace upon him. I am Ali, the grandson of Ali, Fatima, and the Prophet, peace upon them. I am the son of that Imam whose sons were killed and his properties looted and plundered and his family held prisoners before you. You wrote invitation letters to my father. When he came towards you, you killed him. What will you reply to God and his Prophet on the Day of Judgment?" Time does allow us to dwell on the famous sermon of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, in the court of Yazid in Damascus that shook the Umayyad regime to its very foundations and forced the tyrant to release the Ahlul Bayt and send them back to Medina. During the next 34 years of his life, when the Tawabin, or penitents of Iraq, staged an uprising followed by Mukhtar Thaqafi to avenge the blood of his father by bringing to justice almost all perpetrators of the tragedy of Karbala, his tears never ran dry and continued to flow, whether in grief or as thanksgiving to the Lord Most High for his endless favors. His period of imamat was a critical situation in view of the tussle for political power between Abdullah ibn Zubayr and the Umayyads, who were both unworthy of leadership. Both were hostile to him and the Hashemite clan. Both wanted to wipe out the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. As rulers rose, played havoc with Muslim blood and fell to their doom, the fourth Imam adopted a unique form of jihad through the medium of supplications in the divine court. He not just expounded the fundamentals of faith and God's infinite mercy, but also unraveled the mysteries of the science, as is evident by his reference to the weight of light and other amazing facts, something unthinkable in those days. His lasting legacy is Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, famous as Sams of the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He also dictated to his disciples the Risalat al-Huquq, or Treatise of Rights, which details even the most minute rights and has been hailed as a million times better than the UN Charter of Human Rights. Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, however, was no ascetic, unattached and unconcerned of worldly affairs. When the regime in Damascus was helpless in the face of pressures from the Byzantine Empire regarding supply of coins that were engraved with emblems of the Christian creed, he magnanimously sent his son and eventual successor, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, to Syria to give the necessary advice and make arrangements for setting up of the first ever mint in the Islamic realm, thus saving the faith of the Muslims and the drain of the bullion. In 95 AH, at the age of 57, the fourth Imam was martyred through a fatal dose of poison given by Walid I, but not before he had delivered the followers of the Ahlul Bayt from the thorniest periods of their lives. Today, although his tomb in what was the grand mausoleum in the sacred Baqi cemetery of Medina, along with the tombs of his uncle Imam Hassan, his son Imam Muhammad Baqir, and his grandson Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon them, have been blasphemously demolished by the ungodly Wahhabi cult, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, continues to rule the hearts of believers all over the world.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر الله اکبر خمینی رهبر الله اکبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program that is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. And once again, I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I also have my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, on the line. And I'd just like to say salam and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi. We are speaking about the man who changed the world, and we got to the stage where we discussed some personality and characteristics of the Imam, of course, in the last sessions we had. But today we're going to talk about how Imam Khomeini has revived religion put religion on the map in terms of the fact both as far as Islam is concerned and as far as spirituality is concerned around the globe. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, your take on that?
Well, I think one of the important features or one of the important effects or consequences of having a personality like Imam enter the scene was exactly that, what you mentioned, which is that it really was all about reviving Islam. And because at that time we lived in a world where, you know, the Western civilization was dominant.
Yes.
And in that civilization, you know, religion was really becoming a secondary issue.
Yes, it was.
Or was becoming something that was marginal or that was, you know, related to a minority of the population.
Sure.
And then if you look at all the intellectual climate of that time in that dominant civilization, it was, you know, pretty much across the board secular, whether it was left-wing secular, you know, Marxist, or liberal secular, or even on the right. You know, if you look at, you know, movements such as neoconservatism or the kind of secular right wing, if you look at the States or if you look at Thatcher in Britain.
Yeah, yeah. Reminded me of the Iron Lady again, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Jesus.
There really wasn't any more space for any kind of religious discourse.
Sure.
Or the religious discourse that was marginalized.
It was very much marginalized. You're absolutely right, sir.
Or it was, you know, labeled as just, you know, fundamentalist and whatever. And, of course, this also relates to Christianity and the inability of Christianity at that time and still, I would argue today, to really
To cope with the issues of today. That's absolutely right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so here we had, and in Islam we had a similar situation in the sense that when you had the those branches of Islam that didn't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt, they were also confronted with this inability to really offer solutions to, you know, the believers or the people.
Sure.
Maybe less so than Christianity, but still there was a lot of problems.
Sure.
I mean,
to be honest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, the thing is that, you know, hindsight's a great thing, you know, and when we look back on the situation, I mean, when we see what the hell is going on in the Middle East with the Takfiris and all the rest of it, we can certainly understand that, you know, why they were not able to cope with anything because they're pretty much in the pocket of the West, even today. So,
Of course. I mean, that's one aspect of it when you're talking about Takfiris and Ali Saud and that kind of branch.
Yeah.
I'm also talking about, you know, so-called mainstream or, you know, moderate Sunnism.
Absolutely.
Which, because of certain
deficiencies.
Yeah, deficiencies as it relates to, and I'll be very specific, for example,
sure,
that they don't accept logic or logical reasoning.
That's
in their theology,
right. Well,
any longer.
To be honest, you know, Muntik was
a problem. You know, when you want to deal with.
Mm.
When you want to deal with life, when you want to deal with living, you know, in the world on a daily basis and trying to help people, because, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just based on, you know, I'm just going to have personal prayer, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, who needs a religion like that? You know?
Exactly.
And we talked about this, as you may have.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, as you say, that even Muntik was completely dropped by many Sunni madrasas. They don't even study it now. They don't even look at it.
Again, I mean, you know, we have to look at why would we, you know, this is a completely secularized and westernized, modernized version of religion, what a lot of people have in their head, which is that it's just this personal thing. Well, of course, religion is not just a personal thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is the problem that we have is, you know, why do we even, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just a personal thing, you know?
Yeah.
You have, a religion has to be involved socially, has to care about justice, has to care about fighting evil, and has to care about, you know, offering solutions to daily problems. It has to help people.
Sure.
It's not just there to, you know, make them feel good.
Sure.
Okay. Which is what Christianity had become or has become in many instances.
Sure.
Sure. Absolutely.
And so we had these fundamental, structural, historical problems with religion that, you know, was, and as a result, religion was completely leaving the lives of people. It was no longer a factor in the lives of many people.
Sure.
And so, because, as we claim, you know, we have that very pure and real school of Ahlul Bayt, which is the closest that we have to the real deen, the real deen al-haq. Because remember, from an Islamic perspective, we don't have different religions. We have one religion.
Absolutely.
It's the latest version. Yes, and the final version.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the final version of it.
It's the final version of it, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's not like we can say, well, you know, we have Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Yes, we do on a certain level when we're talking about, you know, legally speaking.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
In terms of, you know, the followers of the Ahl al-Kitab having rights and you know,
yes, from a completely fiqh point of view, yes, that's right.
Right,
yes.
But in terms of the reality of it, in terms of what it is that God has revealed to his creation, and the risala that is being, you know, given as guidance to humanity, well, we only have one religion, which is Deen al-Haq, as it says in the Quran, which is, you know, the religion that was revealed to the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Exactly, and that's perfect, that's complete.
And it happens to be called Islam.
Yes.
And in that religion, you have the unfortunate events that occurred after the demise of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that, you know, which is why a certain group within Islam say that they follow the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
The family of the Prophet.
Sure.
And so it is that school out of which Imam Khomeini comes out of.
Exactly.
And it is that pure and what he called the Muhammadi Islam.
The Muhammadi Islam, that's right. You used to say the pure Muhammadan Islam, yes.
Pure Muhammadan Islam, as opposed to, remember what he used to call it?
American Islam.
American Islam.
Yeah, Salami Amriki. Yeah.
Which is that Islam, which is, oh, you know, don't get involved in social matters, don't get involved in political matters,
yes.
It's just a personal thing, you know.
Just have a KFC next to the Kaaba, eh?
Well, and again, I mean, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I think that's so symbolic and that's such a clear example of, you know, what's the, they always talk about, you know, you know, isn't that the biggest perversion itself? That you would, even if it's halal, because they talk about, well, it's halal. You know, it's halal. You know, we have halal KFC. Or
yeah,
halal
KFC
McDonald's,
next to the car.
Or halal McDonald's, or halal whatever.
My God.
And, you know, isn't that just, you know, doesn't that say everything about how they don't understand anything?
Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, missed out on that one.
Right. I mean, you know, forget about Zamzam.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
he should have had a huge Diet Coke.
That just shows that, you know, 1,400 years and they're still Jahil.
They're still Jahil. Absolutely. Thank you for that.
This is the point, you know. And, you know, just look at the ugly stuff they're building there. I mean, it's horrendous what they're doing.
It's horrible what they've done to the place.
You're going to get me started on this now, but
I'd like to get you started, Dr. Manikar.
Well,
Just give it the full treatment.
What Imam Khomeini did was a revival.
Yes.
Not what they're doing.
Not what they're doing.
This is like, you know, just a, how should I say it? These are like a bunch of ignorant people who just recently, you know, as we say, recently became literate or recently, you know, discovered indoor plumbing. And look at what they're doing to Mecca and Medina, you know.
Exactly.
It's a catastrophe. You know, it's a catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe on a grand scale.
Of Islam.
Yeah.
And this is something, I mean, you know, I really wonder at some of these Muslims, and I'm talking Shia and Sunni.
Yeah.
Like, do you care that they're destroying all the history of Islam? Do you even care about that?
Yeah. I mean,
they
have
a clue,
haven't they?
They're destroying the Prophet's house, Khadija's house. They're destroying all the historic mosques.
Sure.
Do you care about that? You don't really care, do you? Because if you did, you would do something about it.
You would do something about it, exactly.
But, well, we don't. We don't care. And it's actually coming up recently. It's going to come up in a few days. I think it's the 8th or 9th of Shawwal where they destroyed Baqi, when they took over Baqi after the Ottomans.
Sure.
Okay? So you have Jannat al-Baqi, which is, you know, the historic, you know, graveyard in Islamic history, where you have, you know, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, you have Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Yes, you have several.
Baqir alayhi salam, you have Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
That's right. Four great imams are buried.
You have besides these, you know, illustrious and luminous, you know, personalities, you have tens and hundreds of others from the beginning of Islam that are buried
there. Yeah, look, absolutely.
And look at it today. You go there and it's like dust, and you know they got it, you know, whatever. And so these are the people that are supposed to be the guardians of Islam and the guardians of the holy sites.
No, they're not guardians of anything.
They're building Big Ben, you know.
Yeah, they're building Big Ben. You're right. Yeah,
They're building this monster version of Big Ben on top of the Kaaba.
Yeah,
you know?
yeah.
That's who they are. I mean, all I'm trying to say to you is, you know, do you really want a sixfold Big Ben shadow over the Kaaba? Is that really because that's what's happening right now? You're doing tawaf and there's a shadow of Big Ben over. Isn't that symbolic of who their master is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Mecca's in London now, so I might as well go there. I might find a Kaaba somewhere around there, next to the Parliament buildings.
They move the Kaaba to, you know.
They move the Kaaba to the Westminster.
You know? Might as well.
Yeah. Oh my God, that says
so,
everything.
You know, what we're talking about is a real revival. We're not talking about this show that they're putting on.
Sure,
know?
Absolutely.
And so that's the thing, is you had this real pure Islam, which was almost forgotten, which they really tried hard to suppress for centuries.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Whether it was
in Iraq,
or whether it was in Iran or whether it was in Lebanon, where they were trying to, you know, label the people who follow that school as, you know, kafir or as whatever.
Exactly.
And then a personality like Imam, you know, Allah brings him, and, you know, how can you deny him? I mean,
this is the problem they had. This was the exact problem. They couldn't deny him. They couldn't deny him.
I'm talking about, you know, your average, you know, Sunni Muslim around the world, you know.
He was completely taken aback.
Right. I mean, you know, anybody who has a genuine love for Allah and for the Prophet, peace be upon him, in the heart, which is what, you know, 96-97% of the Muslims have, Sunni and Shia. So don't get me wrong. I'm trying to say that, you know, it's that tiny, small fraction of Nasibi Takfiri, you know, agents of the West who have a problem with people like Imam. Why would any Muslim in the world have a problem with Imam?
No, I don't think they did have a problem.
Yeah,
they didn't. They had the posters of Imam Khomeini out everywhere.
Right, so nobody had a problem. You know, from Indonesia to Senegal, from, you know, Bosnia to, you know,
right across the Arab world.
Right. I mean, to, you know, to Central Africa. I mean, everybody was like, hey, this guy's cool. We want, you know, this is what we were waiting for, you know.
Yeah, the pictures are still up in New Delhi and India as well as Nigeria.
This is what we were waiting for a real leader in Islam who, you know, is proud to be Muslim, who is not, who understands that Islam is going to give you the solutions in your life.
Yeah.
And who is not trying to, you know, modify Islam to make it a little bit more, you know, socialist or a little bit more liberal or a little bit more westernized bit more easternized, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Who's like, this is it. It's Islam as it was revealed in the Quran, as the Sunnah of the Prophet as it was.
Sure.
And as, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam after the Prophet continued to guide.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this was the real McCoy, as we would say in Scotland.
Right, and so, exactly, the real McCoy. And so the point is that, of course, this is going to lead to a spiritual revival around the world, because this is what humanity
was looking for. Exactly.
And remember, you know, our creation is not separate from Islam. You know, Islam was revealed for our souls.
Yes.
For our being.
For our being, for our very existence.
Right. It's like the software for, you know, our soul.
Exactly.
It's like the instruction manual or the program or the algorithm for our soul. I mean, you're the engineer,
absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, if you take a laptop, it's exactly that. I mean, it's like Windows.
It's like
the operating system.
You know, it's not only the operating system, it's the machine code that the operating system is.
Why are we sounding like the Matrix now all of a sudden? But anyway, the thing is that you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing.
You know, this is not separate from humanity.
No, it is not.
You know, why are we surprised about this? Yeah. Why are we looking at this thing only from a historical perspective? It's not.
It's not history. That's right. It's not history.
You have humanity, both individuals and humanity as a whole, who are thirsting for this guidance from
Allah. Exactly.
And so you have these religions which are atrophied, like Christianity, like certain branches of Islam, which don't. Are not capable of.
No, they're not. You're right. They have atrophied. Very
need, are not able to, you know, quench that thirst that the soul has.
Yes.
And here it is. Here it is. Mm. You know, the Islam of Ahlul Bayt, with an amazing, you know, person like Imam being able to present it to the world.
Exactly. Exactly. And it caused It caused a huge reverberation and revival right across even the Western world because the statistics speak for themselves.
Right, and this is more, and, you know, I'm also saying this to fellow Shias, you know, this is more than just, advertising the religion. This is more than just explaining this is way beyond your traditional, you know, things that a scholar does or like writing a book or holding a speech. This is about living it.
Living it. Ah, well, now there's the key.
Okay.
Because
this is the point. Mm. And this is something that, and I'm addressing this more to the Shias, which is we have a problem in our religious culture, which is we think that all we have to do is, you know, do tabligh.
Yes.
All we have to do is explain the laws.
No, you have
to live it. You have to live
this religion, exactly. Absolutely.
It's not about just, you know, I'm going to tell you what religion is, or this is what the ayah says, or this is what the hadith says.
Sure.
It's about, okay, now implement it in your life.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, and it's interesting. If you look at Imam's books, especially if you look at, you know, Islamic government, Walad Fadi.
That's right.
His point, one of the main themes of Imam Khomeini is that Islam is about action. It's not about just talking about it.
Exactly.
Or having a class about it, or getting an A on your fiqh exam of, you know, I knew all the ahkam. Okay. It's about implementing it.
Living it.
Right. Islam is not, as he used to say, tatil. It's not, it's not closed. You know, the shop is not closed.
No.
It's open.
It's open.
You know?
It's open till the day of judgment.
Right. Just because we're in Ghaibat Kubra, just because we're in the occultation, in the greater occultation, doesn't mean that we close down the religion because the Imam is an occultation. That's, in fact, the whole point is, you got to get the religion going again so the Imam comes. It's not that you're just going to sit there and wait, okay. This is the thing that he used to say, which is, you know, nobody denies that even in the greater occultation, things like prayer, fasting, you know, all those things that we consider to be the normal wajib things, that they exist, right? Nobody denies that, right?
Sure.
Nobody says these things are you know, closed down now because the Imam is not present, correct?
Absolutely.
So he said, well, the same thing goes for having a government. The same thing goes for having a strong Ummah.
Yes.
The same thing goes
for... I couldn't agree more.
You know, why do we see those things are shut down because of the Ghaibat and these things aren't? Well, that's more important than this.
Yes, he was saying that. I mean, he said the establishment of an Islamic government is more important than prayer.
Right. So that doesn't mean you don't pray. Of course you pray.
Of course you pray. But your prayer has to have some value. It has to have some meaning.
Right. And so these are all the things. This is the beauty of what Imam was saying.
He
was a person who really understood Islam.
Yes, he really understood Islam. I think that's you've hit the nail on the head.
You know, we have this famous saying by Shahid Sadr, Shahid Muhammad Baghra Sadr, you know, and may God bless his soul. And, you know, he used to talk about, he said, you know, and I'm trying to say it in English.
Yes.
He was talking about Imam and telling his students and telling the people at that time in Najaf and in Iraq, because Imam was there at that time, before the revolution. He was saying about, he said, you know, melt, and become one with Imam. Zob.
Yes, very
you
good.
You know, like, you know, like an
you
iron.
You dissolve yourself into salt into water.
He said, dissolve yourself into Imam the way Imam dissolved himself into Islam.
Into Islam, mashallah, very nice.
This is the point. Here's a man who was completely immersed, dissolved in Islam.
Yes, yes.
And understood it. And was a very capable, you know, advocate of it and a very capable teacher of Islam.
Sure, sure. The main thing is that, you know, in the last few minutes, if you can sort of just put us in the picture now as to how great the revival has actually been, you know, how great has been the impact on on the world at large in terms of what Imam has done?
That's a good question. Now, let's just look at some examples. We can also just, you know, just what we've experienced in our own lifetime.
Absolutely.
If you look at a country like Iran, which is a major country in the world, in terms of historically, you know.
Strategically, yes.
Strategically, civilization.
Wise,
you know, its location geographically, and, you know, its impact culturally, especially in the Muslim world, in this part of the world, well, obviously you had this big society in this large country. It is one of the largest, you know, countries of the region.
Oh, it is, definitely.
And one of the largest populations. Sure. Well, it completely reversed itself from, you know, going down that westernization and that secularization, which was, you know, being forced onto it during the time of the previous regime.
Hmm.
And now it has become this, you know, intense religious, you know, based society. It doesn't mean everybody is religious. It just means that the framework of the society
is based on religion.
The strategic goals, the laws, and the larger framework in which the society is moving is within the framework of the Quran and the framework of Islam.
Absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And this, this has so many consequences for the rest of the world.
It does, of course it does. It sends out a huge message.
This important nation and this important society moving in this direction. Mm. And the beautiful thing is that it has shown in these last 34 years that you can achieve material and worldly success.
Yes. I mean,
with going in the religious route and going the Islamic route. So it's not about...
And you even become more democratic as well, don't you?
Well, everything from democracy to technology to, you know, development to infrastructure to education, you know...
There's nothing left out.
All the things that they were telling us 30, 40 years ago that you have
to give
up religion and especially give up Islam in order to achieve that. That kind of Turkish model, that kind of, you know, Ataturk.
Yeah.
You know, you have to become European in order to advance.
Yes.
Or the thing which then, you know, Reza Khan in Iran was trying to establish in the you know, 30s.
Days of the Shah, yeah, that's right, yes.
Of course, all of that has been turned on its head.
Exactly.
That
exactly.
Never has, in the history of this nation, this country been so advanced. And so, you know, at the forefront of so many things in the world.
Yes, only in the last 34 years.
And it all came after the establishment of an Islamic government.
Absolutely right.
So this is a major thing. Then you look at all the other movements that are occurring in places like Lebanon, in Iraq.
Yes,
and all these other places.
Yeah.
Where people and, you know, Muslims have awakened. And have decided that they're not going to stand up to occupation and to oppression.
Sure.
And if you look at the miracles that have happened in Lebanon, you know, this so-called, you know, army that couldn't be defeated was defeated.
That's right. We're talking about
you know, the first,
Satan Yahu and his Zionists, yes.
The first Arab army, or the first Arab, you know, I didn't even call it army. It's a militia.
It knocked the fourth strongest army off the map.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's funny how you say it. It's just a militia, you know, but, you know, it's like, so the point is that, we, you know, we have these things that are happening in the Islamic world that, you know, are a result of what Imam was teaching us in terms of following the real Islam.
Exactly, and how much of a difference that's made.
So this was in the Islamic world. You have a lot of the movements that you see in the Sunni world.
Yes,
taking inspiration from what happened.
Very good. Yes, excellent point.
And from Imam himself.
Yes,
and you know, across the board, across the Islamic world, you have this general look. Really, this is something that we have to be very clear about.
Mm-hmm.
When Imam came to the scene, the main thesis, the thing that was dominant, the thought that was dominant and that was being, you know, pushed onto everyone was that you have to give up religion and you have to give up Islam in order to be a civilized human being.
That's a very good point, yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that was, you know, among the Arab elites, it was all Arab nationalism or it was all socialism and Marxism.
Sure.
You know, if you look at all the elites around the world, it was either you were part of the, you know, American camp or you were part of the Soviet camp.
Yeah, the Soviet camp, yeah.
You were either a liberal or a nationalist.
Or a Marxist.
Yeah. And you know, here Imam came and said, no, Islam is the real path.
The real way.
Salvation.
Yes. That's right.
In this world and in the next.
And in the next.
And notice, because people will be like, well, look at what's happening now with these. Well, all these Islamic movements that don't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt or don't follow that kind of, you know, moderate way of looking at things, that way that is based on wisdom that Imam taught us, all of them are failing now.
They are, of course,
and they are. And it's interesting, and I think it's very good to look at an example of what is happening, for example, in Egypt.
In Egypt, I was going to say that.
The minute you had the Ikhwan, you know, becoming friendly with the Takfiris, becoming friendly with the Americans, becoming friendly with that American Islam and that kind of, you know, with the enemies of Islam and not following Imam's path, which is that you stand up to the enemies of Islam.
Sure.
But that you also are not, you know, that you emphasize unity within Muslims.
Sure.
And that you don't try to turn this into a Sunni Shia thing.
Yes.
The minute the Ikhwan started going away from Imam's teachings in these regards, they were completely, you know, defeated.
Exactly.
So, this is the thing.
Yeah.
Imam is not just simply a historic thing that happened 34 years ago or 20 years ago. It's not just, you know, something that was for the history books. Sure. It was about reviving the fitra and allowing that fitra, which is part of all of humanity, to find its real, you know, goal.
Sure.
And be able to find its perfection.
Sure.
And that's why to this day, the more time passes, the more he's relevant.
Exactly.
Okay? The more we realize what a great, incredible human being he was.
I think Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, because we've run out of time and it's been great, thanks very much for that valuable contribution you've made today on this subject of how Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, revived religion not only in the Islamic world but for the world at large as well. But thanks a lot for your contribution today. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just
means,
yeah, thank you very much. And it just leaves me to say, for the rest of our audience, thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening today and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. All the universe calls out the name of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam for its sanctity. However, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the scene of Karbala called out the name of Hazrat Abul Fazl al-Abbas. This shows the great position of Hazrat Abul Fazl al-Abbas in the eyes of his Imam. This was because of the politeness and loyalty of Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas.
این بچه و این فرزند تربیت شده اون مادره.
Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas was educated and nurtured by his mother Ummul Banin. Ummul Banin, at the time of the martyrdom of Imam Ali alayhi salam, had four sons. All of her sons, including Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, were martyred on the day of Ashura in the tragedy of Karbala. She, out of her courtesy for the family of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, did a great sacrifice and gave away her dearest ones in the way of Allah. Thank you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.